Today is Monday, July 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. North Korea blames Seoul for what may be its first case of COVID-19.
That was complicated a little bit today by the fact that South Korea said, yeah, okay, we think this guy did go back from South Korea and to North Korea.
Plus, France moves forward with another investigation into Rwandan genocide.
He worked out a plan with the intent of exterminating the civilian Tutsi population.
And the U.S. shutters a consulate in China. We'll have those stories and more next. The World Health Organization warns COVID-19 is continuing to accelerate globally at breathtaking speed, but says basic public health measures, if followed, can control its spread and turn the pandemic around. Lisa Schlein starts us off.
The number of coronavirus cases globally has roughly doubled in the past 6 weeks. More than 16 million cases of the virus have been reported to the World Health Organization, including more than 640,000 deaths. The Americas is the most seriously affected region, with the United States topping the number of infections at more than 4 million cases and over 143,000 deaths. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says many lessons have been learned since the pandemic was declared a public health emergency of international concern on January 30th. The most important, he says, is that those countries that have applied basic health measures are containing the virus. He says finding, isolating, testing, and tracing contacts, as well as social distancing and wearing masks, can suppress transmission and save lives.
Where these measures are followed, cases go down. Where they are not, cases go up. Countries and communities that have followed this advice carefully and consistently have done well.
Tedros says countries such as Cambodia, New Zealand, Rwanda, and Thailand have succeeded in preventing large-scale outbreaks by following this advice. He says other countries, including Canada, China, and Germany, have brought large outbreaks under control by applying these basic measures. Executive Director of WHO Health Emergencies Mike Ryan says countries that have implemented control measures have suppressed the virus. But when those measures are lifted, the virus returns.
Well, it's clear that pressure on the virus successfully pushes the numbers down. Release pressure on the virus and the numbers can creep back up. Every single country where pressure has been lifted on the virus, where virus is still at community level, there's been a jump back in cases.
WHO officials agree that continuing transmission of COVID-19 and its resurgence in countries where it had been controlled is worrying. However, they say countries can turn the pandemic around by maintaining pressure on the virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australia has recorded its deadliest weekend since the COVID-19 pandemic began. More than 800 new infections have been recorded and more than 15 deaths. Australia has had more than 14,000 confirmed coronavirus infections, resulting in 155 deaths. And Phil Mercer has more.
Face coverings are mandatory in the Victorian state capital, Melbourne. But a woman who refused to wear a mask in a hardware store and filmed her confrontation with staff was later fined by the police.
Just asking if you've got a mask.
Well, it's clear I don't. And you are not authorised to ask me or question me about it.
Would you like to speak to the manager?
Sure.
The Victorian state government reimposed a lockdown in Melbourne and a large area to the north of Australia's second most populous city on July 8. It is scheduled to end on August 19, but could be extended if the COVID-19 crisis isn't contained. More than 530 new infections of coronavirus were reported Monday in Victoria. It is a new daily record for case numbers. Medical workers are pleading with the community to obey lockdown restrictions. Residents can only leave their homes for essential tasks. Abby is a clinical nurse specialist at the Royal Melbourne Hospital's emergency department.
Your temporary but greatly appreciated sacrifice means both you and my colleagues and I will eventually see the light at the end of this very long road. And we collectively may see the end of the pandemic. So please, for the last time, stay home, wear a mask.
Outbreaks have been reported at dozens of aged care facilities in Victoria. The southern state is the epicentre of Australia's COVID-19 emergency, and more troops are being deployed to support a struggling health system. Retired medical staff and paramedics are also being drafted to help. 17 new infections were reported Monday in New South Wales, Australia's most populous state. No fresh infections were detected in the state of Queensland. In Sydney, a planned march by Aboriginal protesters Tuesday has been banned because of public health fears. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This weekend, South Korea revoked the licenses of two North Korean defector groups. I spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo via KakaoTalk about what led Seoul to cancel the licenses for Fighters for Free North Korea and the Newsom Education Center.
Yeah, these balloon launches are not new. For years, South Korean NGOs, mainly North Korean defectors is who runs these groups, they've sent balloons full of pretty provocative leaflets ridiculing North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, or North Korea's human rights record. And these are pretty provocative launches. They contain stuff that, is not necessarily pleasant, and North Korea never likes them, but they have tolerated them to varying degrees. And so has the South Korean government. However, the current South Korean government very much wants to improve relations with North Korea. And so they treat these launches now as something that could damage these efforts. And essentially, they've done everything they can to stop them. They've tried to outlaw them. They've actually trailed these activists. It's really, really a widespread effort to stop these activists from launching balloons.
Now, these rights groups often say that the reason for these launches is to provide information to those in North Korea. And this is coming at a time when North Korea has clamped down in a particular region near the border because of what appears to be a fear that COVID-19 has reached North Korea in a country that has famously said, we have no cases.
Yeah, right. It's true. I mean, North Korea for months has said they're one of the very only countries that have actually said that they have no coronavirus cases. That actually changed sort of this weekend when North Korean state media basically blamed a North Korean defector who had been living in South Korea for the past 3 years, bringing the coronavirus back into North Korea when he came across the border. That was complicated a little bit today by the fact that South Korea said, yeah, okay, we think this guy did go back from South Korea and to North Korea, but we don't think he had the coronavirus.
That was VOA's Bill Gallo speaking to me from Seoul, South Korea. And coming up later...
Eyes closed, legs crossed, and deep in meditation, Hong Kong resident Yang Xiaolan finds herself most at ease, breathing in sync with the sound of music.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Using an instrument on the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope, an international team of astronomers says they recently made the first direct image of more than one planet orbiting a young sun-like star. The astronomers say that the exosystem is located a mere 300 light years away and that the planets are two gas giants. The team says the planets are orbiting their host star at distances that are much farther out than our solar system's gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn. The inner planet is said to be located some 24.3 billion kilometers from its star, while the outer planet is twice that distance at 48.6 billion kilometers. The team also calculated that the inner planet has a mass 14 times that of Jupiter, while the outer planet's mass is about 6 times that of our largest planet. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Beijing announced the U.S. consulate in the southwestern city of Chengdu was closed as of 10 a.m. local time on Monday after it ordered the facility shut in retaliation for China being ousted from its consulate in Houston, Texas. Reuters' Libby Hogan has this update.
It follows a dramatic escalation of worsening relations between the world's two largest economies. and tit-for-tat consulate closures after the U.S. ordered China to close its consulate in Houston, Texas, last week. The Chengdu consulate opened in 1985 and has nearly 200 employees, according to its website. The weekend saw a flurry of removal vans come and go as staff removed belongings. And on Saturday evening, a worker could be seen removing a plaque outside the main entrance. Security was tight, but a steady stream of people walked along the street opposite the entrance, many stopping to take photos or videos before police moved them on. Residents in Chengdu expressed mixed views on the US consulate there, with one saying that he thought it was a reciprocal action, whilst another felt uneasy about the incident.
All of this makes me feel a little uncomfortable, you know, such drastic steps. I think that when it comes to the US as a country, I can't say anything good or bad.
US-China relations have plunged to their worst in decades over a range of disputes. From trade to the coronavirus pandemic, China's territorial claims in the South China Sea, and its clampdown on Hong Kong.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. With November's U.S. general election just 100 days away, a new poll may be a sign of trouble for U.S. President Donald Trump's re-election prospects. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
President Trump's motorcade stopped along a New Jersey roadside Sunday afternoon so he could thank a group of supporters who'd gathered to cheer him. But the latest Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll suggests the odds of them getting their wish may be getting longer. 80% of respondents say the country is headed in the wrong direction. That's higher than at any previous point in the Trump presidency. Just 38% say the national economy is good, a big drop from January when 67% said it was doing well, and views on President Trump's handling of the coronavirus pandemic have hit a new low. Just 32% of respondents approve of his approach. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Followers of the Chinese spiritual movement Falun Gong in Hong Kong now fear that they are at risk under China's new national security law. Reuters' Gloria So explains.
Eyes closed, legs crossed, and deep in meditation, Hong Kong resident Yang Xiaolan finds herself most at ease, breathing in sync with the sound of music. But after China enacted a new national security law for Hong Kong, she no longer feels safe in the city. Yang is a follower of the spiritual movement called Falun Gong. The group urges people to renounce the ruling Chinese Communist Party and is banned in mainland China. Yang moved to Hong Kong in 2009, where members have been able to practice Falun Gong freely, at least for now. But under the new security law, which punishes crimes of secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces with up to life in prison, Yang Xiaolan is worried about her future.
In the mainland, when I practiced Falun Gong, my life was constantly under threat. I could be kidnapped or disappear anytime, or even lose my life anytime. I never felt a sense of security.
Founded in mainland China in 1992, Falun Gong combines meditation and slow-motion exercises with moral teachings broadly based on Buddhism and Taoism. Leader Li Hongzhi also adds some unorthodox theories, such as his belief that aliens have started to take over the world. Falun Gong was banned in the mainland in 1999 after 10,000 practitioners of the movement silently protested in Beijing. The Chinese Communist Party saw the group's growing popularity as a challenge to its rule and called it an evil cult that threatened national stability, jailing several of its members. China's new security law makes no mention of religious or spiritual groups, but a Falun spokeswoman said two members have already left Hong Kong fearing for their safety.
Hong Kong's one country, two systems formula has changed even before the deadline. For us, including my family, we're very scared. It could be just like in mainland China, where the police can trample on the law and anything can be in violation of the law. There's no sense of safety.
Although Falun Gong and its street stalls have largely been left in peace by the Hong Kong government so far, members have faced opposition from pro-Beijing groups for years.
We strongly condemn Falun Gong.
The Hong Kong government has declined to comment on how the new security law would impact Falun Gong, but said the law preserves, quote, the basic rights and freedom lawfully enjoyed by law-abiding citizens. And Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin doubled down on China's criticism of the group at a press conference last week.
Falun Gong is a cult organization outlawed by the Chinese government. It's anti-society, anti-science, anti-humanity.
Yang and six of the some 300 Falun Gong devotees who regularly practice across Hong Kong told Reuters they plan to continue as they did before the law. But some members say there have already been changes. A prominent banner used to adorn one of Falun Gong's stalls in Kowloon suddenly disappeared about 2 weeks after the new law was implemented. Hong Kong police declined to comment on Falun Gong and said it did not track national security complaints against specific groups. And Reuters could not independently verify that the police were behind the removal of any banners.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. Officials in France have announced that they have located a former Rwandan spy chief suspected of playing a major role in the planning of the extermination of the civilian Tutsi population, which led to the deaths of more than 800,000 people in Rwanda. The news comes 2 months after the arrest in a Paris suburb of Felicien Kabuga, the man suspected of financing Rwanda's 1994 genocide. International Edition's Lori London got the details from journalist Catherine Field in Paris.
Over the weekend, French authorities announced that they had opened a preliminary investigation into one of the suspects, one of the key suspects of the Rwandan genocide. It was the former head of military intelligence. His name is Aloys Ntahuihagabo. He was living in Orléans, which is about 100 miles southwest of Paris. What all we know about him so far is what we've read and all the indictments and the evidence that was put forward by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Now, the main allegation against this former head of military intelligence is that from 1992 until July 1994, along with 11 others, he worked out a plan with the intent of exterminating the civilian Tutsi population by drawing up lists of enemies and their accomplices. Other indictments for various others that have the documentation in the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda say that he also took part in daily meetings at which they were informed of the massacres of the civilian Tutsi population. Now, of course, he denies these charges, and he makes it very clear that he was not in and he makes it quite clear that he was actually not in Rwanda on the 6th of April when that plane did come down. But it is pretty clear when you're reading through all the documents, all the indictments by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, that he was indeed, or is, one of the suspected architects of that Rwanda genocide.
So now that they know his whereabouts, do we know if they've actually spoken to him and if they plan an arrest, or what are you hearing about what comes next with this if he's being investigated for crimes against humanity? And it's from France, not even in the International Criminal Court?
Indeed. It was actually a news website that tracked this man down. They had been investigating him for some 7 months, trying to find out where he was living. It's anyone's guess how many suspects from the Rwanda genocide are actually living in France. Depending on who you believe, there are at least a dozen. Others say there are several dozen. But this particular website had been investigating this man. His wife had come to France in 1998, was given asylum, and was naturalized French citizen in 2005. Now, that enabled him to join her here. And in fact, they've been living in social housing that's been provided for them at reduced rate by the state.
Wow.
That is as much as we know. The Paris High Court does have special powers to try crimes that were committed outside French jurisdictions. And this is the court which may end up hearing this. It's a special court set up in 2013, which can look into crimes, serious violations of international humanitarian law, and that is crimes against humanity. So they could be brought into this. They will be keeping an eye on this case. But there was a lot of criticism that this particular court isn't working fast enough. and that this is exactly the sort of case they should have been looking into quite some time ago. But of course, all this does go back to, I think you could honestly say, that undertaking that French President Emmanuel Macron made in April 2019, that France would do all it could to ensure any genocide suspects who are living in France will be prosecuted.
And Catherine, I understand there has been at least one statement, response about this from one of the groups, one of the communities working to seek justice for the horrific genocide.
Yes, in a statement, Bouc of France did ask why so many suspected genociders who are on the run are living in France quite peacefully. And they do ask the question, why have so few of these people faced French justice for 26 years?
Catherine Field is a journalist in Paris, and she was speaking to International Edition's Laurie London. An actor best known for starring alongside Bruce Lee in a popular kung fu movie has died. AP Entertainment correspondent Oscar Wells Gabriel looks back at the life and career of John Saxon.
Oh, no sweat.
John Saxon was a versatile actor who appeared in several films, in the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, and he was nominated for a Golden Globe Award in 1966 for his work with Marlon Brando in The Appaloosa. But for many, his most enduring role was when he co-starred in Enter the Dragon. He literally fought his way into the hearts of moviegoers as Mr. Roper, the martial arts expert who takes on all comers in the movie, alongside Bruce Lee and Jim Kelly. The Hollywood Reporter quotes Saxon's wife as saying the actor died at his home in Tennessee on Saturday. He was 83 years old. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Through the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center, or TFTC, the United States and its Gulf partners collaborate to combat the financing of terrorist organizations in the Middle East and around the world. The seven members, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and the United States, share financial intelligence to target activities that pose a threat to the national security of its members. Since its inception in 2017, the TFTC has issued five rounds of joint designations against over 60 terrorist individuals and entities spanning the globe. These designations targeted a wide range of terrorist organizations, including ISIS and its affiliates, Al-Qaeda, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Lebanese Hezbollah, and the Taliban. Most recently, the TFTC announced the designation of six individuals and entities affiliated with ISIS as part of its efforts to disrupt ISIS's ability to finance its global operations. These sanctions impact three Syria-based money services businesses, Al Haram Exchange, Tawassul Company, and Al Khalidi Exchange, along with a senior ISIS financial facilitator, Abd al-Rahman Ali Hussein al-Ahmed al-Rawi, and Afghanistan-based Nijat Social Welfare Organization and its director, Syed Habib Ahmad Khan. These individuals and entities were previously designated by the United States pursuant to Executive Order 13224. All property and interests in property of these targets that are or come within the United States or in the possession or control of U.S. persons must be blocked and reported to the Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC. OFAC's regulations generally prohibit all dealings by U.S. persons or within the United States, including transactions transiting the United States, that involve any property or interest in property of blocked persons. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin highlighted the TFTC's efforts to maximize the disruption of terrorist financing around the world. The TFTC has brought the U.S. and its Gulf partners closer together to confront shared regional threats and build the lasting capacity to target terrorist financial networks wherever they operate. The TFTC designations, said U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement, serve as a further warning to individuals and businesses who provide financial support or material assistance to terrorist organizations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.